This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Many veterans' lives have been saved by modern protective technology, but that doesn't mean their time at war has come without a cost. Brain injuries have been called the signature wound of American troops returning from wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they have serious impacts on the physical, mental, and emotional lives of returning vets.
But when it comes to the science behind traumatic brain injuries, there are a lot of gray areas. What exactly causes it, what the effects are, and how to treat it. Our next guest looks at efforts from the worlds of science and art to try to come to grips with the problem.
Caroline Alexander joins us now. Her books include The Endurance, Shackleton's Legendary Antarctic Expedition, and The Bounty. Today we're talking about her National Geographic cover story, The Invisible War on the Brain. Caroline, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, the online version of your piece includes the voices of some of the veterans you talked to. I wanted to play a bit. Here's an Army First Sergeant named David talking about his experience with PTSD and traumatic brain injury.
It's those unseen scars, unseen stuff. And sometimes you find yourself saying, you know, I wish I would have, you know, when I got injured, I would have lost a body part. So people will see, so they'll get it. You know, if my hand or arm or whatever just been blown off, then they would understand. They would see that there's something wrong with you, and so they'd spend the time.
So because these traumatic brain injuries, we can't see them. They're invisible to the outside observer. Is that part of why we've been slow to come to grips with the impact of traumatic brain injuries among veterans?
Very much so. Everything about this condition is inscrutable. In the first instance, it bears the symptoms of blast-induced traumatic brain injury, to use its very particular term. It appears to overlap symptomatically with those of PTSD. So, for example, somebody who's been in the field, experienced an IED, possibly at a distance, possibly not himself being or herself being blown up, might come back shaken by the event, perhaps witnessed somebody else get injured, which was very upsetting and traumatic, and months afterwards just finds that memory isn't as good as it used to be, that he might be having a little bit of difficulty finding words, can't sleep, has a headache, has ringing in his ears, but it's not the kind of thing that you would necessarily run to get treatment for. You know, so the first thing is that the symptoms themselves can be subtle, a little unquantifiable, and appear also to overlap with just stress or post-traumatic stress syndrome. So the symptoms are difficult to quantify on the one hand, and then there has been, up until just about now, this moment almost, very little effective technologies that allow us to look inside the brain for the kind of damage that blast is inflicting. It seems to be causing damage at the microtissue level, and there just aren't mechanisms. There's a hint of them coming that have allowed one to look into the brain of a living soldier and report back and say, yes, we can see something here, something is wrong with you.
And the causes of these injuries, you mentioned IEDs, the improvised explosive devices. You also in your piece talk about breaching, getting through a wall or a door or a fortification by intentionally setting off an explosive. As I read what you're writing about, it seems like concussions from these blasts at levels way lower than we would have previously thought can cause these kind of brain injuries.
Yes, there's a lot that we're learning, and the breachers were, in a way, the canaries in the mine shaft. The breachers are the guys like the Navy SEALs who burst, exploded away into the bin Laden's compound. They're the people who set controlled explosives offensively to get into structures, usually. And so these are people who, there had been a lot of anecdotal reports that they appeared to be suffering symptoms of neurological conditions, but it was all a little bit anecdotal. So a study was done in 2008, which followed a group of breacher instructors over a two-week training period, and the training was on home turf, which is to say in the United States. So this was very clarifying, because you had a group of guys who were professionals, who enjoyed, in fact, what they did, who weren't suffering from PTSD, and who weren't getting blown off their feet. They weren't being experienced, you know, where they were knocked out or knocked unconscious or anything like that. And at the end of the two-week period, it was found that they they manifested signs of neuro. They performed less well on their neurobehavioral tests than they had 2 weeks previously. So this was a real wake-up call, because suddenly people realize all those thresholds that we have for measuring whether people are at risk for damage are based on false assumptions. So in the past, it was, did you lose consciousness? Were you unconscious for this amount of time or that amount of time? But now it appears that low-level exposure to low-level blast is also damaging, particularly, it seems, when it's repetitive. And it's not strictly concussion. It appears not to be the kind of injury that we get in blunt force trauma, such as, I say, a football head injury or an automobile accident where your head is concussed. And so many of the neurologists I spoke with were advocated new terminology entirely, such as blast-induced neurotrauma, just to distinguish it from the more conventional concussions we know of in the civilian world.
Now, the scary and sad thing here is that in many of these cases, someone has just been wounded, possibly for life. They don't know that they've been wounded. There's no blood. There's no shrapnel. There's no immediate indication that they've been hit in a way.
Exactly. Very much so. And I mean, one of the veterans I spoke with, who has now been securely dosed with traumatic brain injury, himself, in a way, both self-diagnosed, understood, knew some years down the line that there was something wrong with him, and then this was sort of confirmed by the clinical observation conducted by the doctors. He describes, the event that he now knows was sort of the final straw. He'd been exposed to some other events before, but he knows that this one kind of tipped him over the edge. But he came to, in this case, he was knocked out, and he came to his senses, and the first thing he did was look for blood, and there was no blood. So he thought he was good. It's like all my limbs are here. I can see. I can speak. I know where I am. I escaped. And then you have to think that tours of duty come to an end, you're safe home, you've made it, maybe your buddies didn't make it, maybe they're severely injured, you feel yourself to be very much the lucky one, and the adjustment back to civilian life is a little bit trickier than you thought, you find you're fumbling with things that you thought you could do well, but you wouldn't necessarily jump to the conclusion that this is real damage. And so this is where this dreadful gray zone appears, because it's very difficult, even now, even with the condition sort of on the table and people really concerned about it, it's still very hard to determine precisely if somebody has this or indeed is just suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder or just readjusting. The two most diagnostic symptoms are a headache that doesn't go away, migraine-type headache, and ringing in your ears. Those are symptoms that are not do not overlap with post-traumatic stress disorder or any psychological adjustment issue. So those would be clearly indicative of something else, of the physiological damage.
Is there a thought that maybe some of what we thought was PTSD all along is actually this blast-related traumatic brain injury?
That's a very good question, and the answer is yes. There's a strong belief now, and this is particularly relevant to the high rate of suicides that have followed in the wake of the campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan, that it is strongly thought now that exposure to blast, that the language that's used is quite cautious, but they say sort of predispose or make enhance vulnerabilities to certain psychiatric conditions. And that's a sort of medicalese way of saying that they believe, all our emotional states, cognitive states, obviously originate in the brain, in the physical brain. And so if the physical brain is actually injured, it's not surprising that there would be, that our self-expression, whether intellectually or emotionally, would go awry. And so this is now very much what people are starting to quantify or attempt to quantify. It's still, and the other thing is there's a genuine overlap, which is to say that if you've, been exposed to a blast event, it is traumatic. You undoubtedly would have some kind of psychological trauma that one would carry out from that event. But you may also have the other, the physiological condition. And so right now it's a kind of waiting game, waiting to see how the condition reasserts itself down the line in years to come. So the only thing that doctors can do at this point is sort of advocate vigilance on the part of VAs or other medical practitioners, services that actually have to treat or see or interact with veterans on the one hand, and vigilance on the part of veterans for themselves and for friends that they know who were also in combat, so that they can sort of track, because really right now it's only observational. It's only by self-expressing your symptoms in a way that many, you know, that a diagnosis can be made.
We're talking to Caroline Alexander about her National Geographic piece looking at the impact of brain injuries on U.S. veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And you can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. If you're a veteran of these conflicts, is this something that's affected you or maybe other people in your unit? Or maybe you have a family member dealing with these problems. If you work in healthcare, have you worked with veterans showing these symptoms? You can call and share what you've seen at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, get a little into the science and the art involved in trying to heal these veterans after a look at the headlines with Kristen Durst. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. We continue our conversation with Caroline Alexander. She wrote about traumatic brain injuries for U.S. veterans in her National Geographic cover story. It's called The Invisible War on the Brain.
And you can join in. Is this an issue that has affected you or someone close to you? Do you have questions about the research and treatment of these brain injuries in veterans? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we go to our callers, Caroline, an interesting point you brought up in your piece. Going back to World War One, the phrase shell shock actually may have been closer to the mark for a lot of injured World War One soldiers than we thought in the years since.
Absolutely. In fact, that's what drew me into the story. I've done quite a bit of research on World War One, and I had done a story on shell shock, and I was immersed in the medical literature of that era. And this was about the time that the news media started reporting on a strange new condition or perplexing condition that was manifesting itself in veterans in Iraq. And it was, you know, it looked like it was PTSD, but it also looked like it had something else going on as well. And I would get used to just reading almost as a kind of exercise down the paragraph, waiting for where it would come and note that it would say that the individual in question had been exposed to blast event. It was just like seeing a mirror of what had happened in World War One, and I certainly feel that part of that medical knowledge could have been further ahead than it is now had the medical community over the past century kind of continued caring about this issue. It's quite remarkable. You have the signature injury of the most catastrophic war possibly in world history, which was shell shock, left, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of men with this condition. And then it was as if the world just heaved a big sigh of relief and said, well, that's over. You know, we won't bother with it. And then lo and behold, 100 years passes, and we're once again in a kind of conflict that makes great use of explosive force. And one of the reasons I wrote the story was I don't want the same thing to happen to the modern veterans that happened to the veterans of 100 years ago, which is essentially that they got forgotten. And, you know, it's really instructive to think that for decades of my life, there were still veterans alive in old age from World War One, and they were languishing in places, you know, you never saw them, never heard of them, never thought about them. But that's what happens. History, you know, moves very quickly, and we tend to forget one conflict and put it behind us and then move on to the next big issue. And so I think it's very important now, while there's, you know, there's interest in this, and it's, you know, I wanted to sort of put it on the table, have people pay attention, because whatever policies we make now are what people are going to live with down the line.
Let's bring a caller into the conversation. Ian is with us in Milwaukee. Ian, hi.
How's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Ian?
I just was calling in with kind of a firsthand example that I've had. My best friend since I was 9 until about 18, we were next door neighbors, inseparable, and then we kind of, you know, separated at the end of high school. And his route was to kind of like succumb to the recruiters. He was a big guy. He liked video games, and they I don't mean to say lured, but he was kind of lured in. He was a very innocent, big teddy bear. And then flash forward 2 years, I haven't seen him in 1 year's training and 1 year's Afghanistan, and he comes back with a different look in his eye. He's not, he's still there, but it's like a, almost like a whipped dog look, because it's just, it's not comparable to living here for most of his life. So he comes back, and we kind of have like this one night we were drinking, and he kind of starts telling me just kind of weird things, and he starts getting really weird with holding a knife and stuff, and I kind of just, I couldn't believe that's like where my friend had gotten to. And I very angry, but I don't really hang out with him because it hurts me to see it. And since then, I hear rumors of body counts and things like that, and it's like he went in there, I know, as my innocent friend, and that's what kind of like happened to him. And
Ian, thank you so much for calling. I wanted to bring Caroline Alexander here. Now, this could be a case of PTSD. It could be a traumatic brain injury or something else. But you talk to a lot of veterans who have been diagnosed with traumatic brain injury. Is there that sense that they feel like a different person? The people who know them see them as a different person after this injury?
Yes. I thought it was a very moving story. Mm-hmm. It's one I've heard a lot. And indeed, in our in the National Geographic story, the what we try to do for those who haven't seen it yet is there's the text is very much about the science, if you will, but the illustrations are very unusual, and they're masks that the veterans painted of their own faces, showing how they feel themselves inside themselves, the things they can't express verbally, and they're horrific. I mean, they're tortured faces, and so that. And that whipped dog look, that horrifying expression, is something that one of the mothers describes of her son when he came back, you know, that she just looked in his eyes and he wasn't the same person. The other thing to just note, you know, if you have friends that you're concerned about, one of the places that seems to be getting damaged a lot is the frontal lobe, which is the part of the brain that controls your executive function. It's your control mechanism. It's your impulse management center, and so it's thought possibly that one of the reasons there's so many suicides is because it's almost like you have a teenage brain. It hasn't quite formed in a teenager, and they do impulsive, stupid things like pull a knife on somebody. And so I would, it could be PTSD, as you rightly said. But if there's any concern, I suggest, you know, that all that one can do is counsel whoever you know, if they have these troubling symptoms, to just go in and see, go to the VA, go to a doctor, and describe their history in warfare. Were they exposed to any blast events? And try and get some help for this, some ways of managing it.
Ian, thanks for calling and sharing that, and good luck to your friend. We'll go now to Stefan in Madison. Stefan, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on. I was a senior explosive ordnance disposal technician, so we were the guys actually defusing bombs. And my question is regarding to the cumulativeness of these different exposures. So when we judge an explosion, we would relate to it in K factors, which in turn relates to PSI. And I was wondering if there's a specific PSI that the patient has to be exposed to in order for these individual events to become cumulative.
Stefan, thanks for that call. PSI would be pounds per square inch, right?
Pounds per square inch.
And do we know if there's that threshold established yet?
No, we don't. And first of all, I should say, I think we will know soon. There is a paper that will be coming out sometime this year that I think is going to be greatly clarifying by showing exactly what it is that's damaged in the brain, and I think we can work backwards from that. So we don't know safety standoff distances. We don't know what the PSI thresholds are. One of the things that's darkly fascinating, though, to me, is when you look at these kind of safety sheets that are handed out, you know, that this number of PSI, you'll rupture your eardrum, this much will hurt your lungs, this much will do this and that and the other, this much is fatality. The brain is not even in it. I mean, it just is astonishing in retrospect that with all the internal organs that people were concerned about with trying to establish these thresholds, which it turns out were wrong, that the brain was never even considered. And it shows, you know, how much behind the curve we're starting with this research.
Stefan, thanks for the call. Good luck. And thanks for doing that dangerous work. Caroline, you'd mentioned that mask project that some of these veterans had been doing. And by the way, we've got a link to some pictures of that that you had. We've got that at the Central Time Facebook page. You talk about one veteran who thought, why am I doing this? This isn't kindergarten. Why am I painting with this little brush? But yeah, he turned around on it.
Well, it's the program is run out of Walter Reed, and it's an art therapy program, and it's a form. I know it's been used, for example, with abused children. And also, by the way, art therapy was used in World War I, so it's a well documented form of emotional release. So is meditation, by the way, which is something that one of the top rehab docs told me that, but these, it has to be stressed, help treat the psychological aspect of the injury. They don't heal the brain, and the there is nothing that heals the brain at the moment that is known of. All we have are management systems. So if one is diagnosed with TBI, the best type of treatment you're going to get will be trying to address each of those symptoms, whether it's sleeplessness or headaches or anger or impulse or anxiety. And each of those will be treated in a different way. And the art therapy, the mask making, speaks to one aspect of that management. But it would be false to imply that it is in some sense, it's solace. It gives solace, it gives release, it gives expression, but it doesn't actually heal you.
Caroline, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Caroline Alexander. She's a contributing writer for National Geographic magazine. She wrote the magazine's February cover story, The Invisible War on the Brain. We have that piece linked over at the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.